stories that leave my children asking questions like, how could Santa not bring toys for some kids when, Mommy, you told us that all kids are good inside? Despite my dislike for cleaning pine needles from every nook and cranny, I love celebrating Christmas. I love watching my children count the days till December 25th, a countdown that seems to get harder every year. I remember when having to wait a week for Nowruz felt like an eternity. And just as my father assured me that Nowruz was indeed around the corner, I assure my kids that Christmas will be here before they know it. Even though I'm too old to believe in Santa Claus, I'm just the right age for baking Christmas cookies. What's Christmas without bourbon balls, gingerbread, and fudge? I'm not sure which I enjoy more, the flavors or the smells, but either way, they remind me of the excitement of Nowruz. My Christmas kitchen smells of ginger, chocolate, and cinnamon. In my childhood kitchen, Nowruz smelled of cardamom, roasted pistachios, and rose water. And in every Iranian living room, the sweet scent of hyacinths trumpeted the arrival of Nowruz and the beginning of spring. In America, our Christmas tree fills our house with the unmistakable aroma of pine, a scent I now associate with winter celebrations. Despite my new love for Christmas, I often find myself exhausted at the end of December. Christmas, with its elf laborers and flying reindeer, is far more complicated than Nowruz. In between all the cooking and cleaning, I try my best to answer my children's many questions. I do my best to explain how Santa manages to deliver so many presents in just one night, and how he manages not to trip anyone's burglar alarm, and how it is that Santa doesn't have a bad back, even though he's an old man and he has to carry so much stuff. At times like this, I yearn for the simpler days of yore, when Christmas meant watching Bob Hope sing his version of White Christmas, as my parents and I slumped on the sofa in our summer clothes in the warm Newport Beach weather. Now every Christmas Eve, when the kids are finally in bed, the dishes are washed, and the log is on its final breath, I can't help but think of Bob Hope. I wonder if he realizes that in my childhood home, he was way bigger than Santa Claus. Mr. Hope, unlike the bearded fellow, came to everyone's house. And even though my parents didn't understand any of his jokes, I got them all. And they were funny in both English and Persian. So, Mr. Hope, thank you. And Merry Christmas to all, and to all, a good night. I ran and I ran and I ran. In 1977, the Shah and his wife were scheduled to come to America to meet the newly elected president, Jimmy Carter. Very few Iranians lived in America then, and those of us who did were invited to go to Washington, D.C. to welcome the Shah. The Iranian government would cover all expenses. My father accepted the invitation. My brothers reacted with a few choice words. Are you completely crazy? Haven't you heard about the anti-Shah demonstrators? You'll definitely get beaten up. Don't go. My brothers clearly did not understand the lure of the phrase, all expense paid trip. A few weeks later, drinking fresh squeezed orange juice in our first class seats, my parents and I looked forward to our first visit to the nation's capital. During our three-night stay, we were supposed to show up at two events welcoming the Shah. The rest of the time was our own. My father had promised to take me to at least one museum. My mother looked forward to seeing the famous sights. We arrived at our hotel to find the lobby full of Iranians. Unaccustomed to seeing so many of our fellow countrymen in one place, my parents started mingling feverishly, discovering friends of friends and long-forgotten colleagues. As we went to find our room, we felt like a bunch of kids on a field trip. A fruit basket would have been nice, but instead we found that a flyer had been slipped under the door. Dear brainwashed cowards, you are nothing but puppets of the corrupt Shah. We will teach you a lesson you will never forget. Death to the Shah, death to you. My father crumpled the flyer and threw it away. Let's find out where they're having the dinner buffet, he said. The next day, half a dozen buses lined up in front of our hotel to take us to the lawn across from the White House. We were given Iranian flags and told to wave them at the Shah's arrival. Moments before we left, a man boarded our bus and introduced himself as a lawyer working for the Iranian government. "In case anybody attacks you," he told us, "please try to take his picture. This would be most useful." We arrived at the White House to find a group of masked demonstrators carrying signs denouncing the Shah and his government. "Don't worry," my father assured me. "They're on the other side of the street." Opposite the demonstrators, scaffolding had been built for the Shah's supporters. Speakers took turns giving speeches on the glories of Iran. To my delight, I found that the lawn had been strewn with miniature Iranian flags. "Help me find 30 of them," I asked my parents. "I'm going to hand them out in Miss Crockett's social studies class." My mother and I headed toward the back of the lawn, while my father went to the front to look for more flags. A few minutes later, we heard my father say, "Look how many I found!" He held up his bounty, but his voice was drowned out by the 21-gun salute announcing the arrival of the Shah's limousine. People started to cheer, but the cheering wasn't entirely cheerful. The demonstrators had crossed the road. They were stampeding toward us, waving sticks with nails driven into them. People were screaming and running. Instead of Iranian flags, the lawn was suddenly covered with bloody and injured Iranians. My parents and I ran and ran and ran. We found an empty bus and, not caring about its destination, climbed on board. "I'm sorry, folks," the bus driver drawled. "Y'all are gonna have to get off this bus 'cause it's out of service and I'm on break." Across the street, we found a police officer on horseback. "Excuse me," I said. "We're afraid that we're gonna get beaten up. Could you please help us get back to our hotel?" Perhaps this officer had joined the police force because of the handsome uniforms, or perhaps he wanted a job that let him ride a horse. He looked at us and said, "Sorry, that's not my job." Spotting another bus, we boarded it immediately. "Do you have tickets?" the driver asked. "How much are they?" We paid $21 and took our seats just as the bus started to leave. We had no idea where we were going. A recorded narration began. "Our next stop is the Lincoln Memorial, built in honor of Abraham Lincoln, the 16th President of the United States. On the north wall of this majestic memorial, you will see the words of the Gettysburg Address. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth..." 3 hours, 4 monuments, and 1 cab ride later, we arrived at our hotel. The lobby was filled with bandaged survivors exchanging horror stories. At the sight of all the wounded, my father turned to my mother and me and said, "Don't mention we went on a tour. It's going to look bad that we were having fun while everyone else was suffering." Before I could tell my father that the tour had not been fun, he was accosted by a friend whose arm was now in a sling. "Where have you three been the whole time? We were getting ready to call the hospitals." "Well," my father sighed, "we had to walk back." Like a story written in installments, a second flyer awaited us in our room. "Dear brainwashed cowards, we are going to blow you up." Even the prospect of the dinner buffet was no longer enough to keep us in the nation's capital. "That's it," my father announced. "We're leaving." 6 hours later, we found ourselves in the coach section of a crowded airplane, sitting in 3 different rows. We were thrilled to be headed home. As the airplane took off, my father turned around and shouted from 4 rows ahead of me, "That really wasn't that bad. Firuze, you know how you like historical places? Well, we saw a bunch." He continued, "Of course, I do have one regret." "What's that?" I yelled back. "I shouldn't have dropped all the flags. I'm sure I had enough for your whole class." "That's okay," I replied. "We can always go back." Iranians need not apply. At the age of 17, my father began working for NIOC, the National Iranian Oil Company, as a student employee. He worked his way up the corporate ladder and eventually became a senior project manager. His lifetime of experience with oil refineries brought us to America, where he worked as a representative of NIOC, supervising American contractors in the design of an oil refinery in Isfahan. After 33 years of working with the same company, my father never doubted the security of his future. But with the Iranian Revolution, my father's world turned upside down. The building of more refineries in Iran was halted, and overnight, my father's expertise was no longer needed. Although NIOC offered him other positions in Iran, none was within his field of interest. With much dismay, he requested and was reluctantly granted early retirement. My father was confident in his abilities to find a job in the United States. Within a couple of weeks, he found an engineering position with an American company. As he was settling into his new job, a group of Americans in Tehran were taken hostage in the American embassy. My father was laid off. Every evening, we sat in front of the television and watched the news for updates on the hostage situation. For 444 nights, we waited. With each passing day, palpable hatred grew among many Americans. Hatred not just of the hostage takers, but of all Iranians. The media didn't help. We opened our local paper one day to the screaming headline, "Iranian robs grocery store." Iran has as many fruits and nuts as the next country, but it seemed as if every lowlife who happened to be Iranian was now getting his 15 minutes of fame. Vendors started selling T-shirts and bumper stickers that said, "Iranians, go home," and "Wanted, Iranians for target practice." Crimes against Iranians increased. People would hear my mother's thick accent and ask us, "Where are you from?" They weren't looking for a recipe for stuffed grape leaves. Many Iranians suddenly became Turkish, Russian, or French. To add to my family's collective anxiety, my father's pension from Iran was cut off. The Iranian government told him that from now on, if he wanted his hard-earned retirement pay, he would have to go to Iran to collect it. Even worse, with the turmoil in Iran, the value of my father's pension dropped to the point of worthlessness. At 58, my father found himself unemployed and with no prospects. Nobody wanted to hire an Iranian. My father returned to Iran to sell all our belongings. Within 3 weeks, he sold our house for a tenth of its previous value. A colleague bought our 14 room-size Persian rugs for $1,300 and sold one of them for $15,000 a few months later. Perhaps the greatest irony in the wave of Iranian hating was that Iranians, as a group, are among the most educated and successful immigrants in this country. Our work ethic and obsession with education make us almost ideal citizens. Nobody asked our opinion of whether the hostages should be taken, and yet every single Iranian in America was paying the price. One kid throws a spitball and the whole class gets detention. For my father to be treated like a second-class citizen truly stung. If there were ever a poster child for immigration, it would be Kazem. Perhaps nothing speaks louder than his obsession with voting. When I became an American citizen, in college, my father called to ask whether I was planning to vote in the upcoming election. "If I have time," I answered. My father then told me that perhaps I did not deserve to be a citizen. Any immigrant who comes to this country and becomes a citizen and doesn't vote, according to him, should just go back. "What about American citizens who are born here and don't vote?" I asked, egging him on. "They need to be sent for 6 months to a non-democratic country, then they'll vote," he replied. I told my father that his ship him abroad program didn't sound too democratic to me, that perhaps included in the freedoms in this country is the freedom to be apathetic. He hung up on me. I voted. But that wasn't the end of it. After every election, my father called me to ask whom I had voted for. After several such phone calls, we realized that our votes simply negate each other. We stand on opposite sides of all issues. I have since learned not to share any information with my father, instead reminding him that the voting process is confidential, which explains why there are booths instead of, say, people just raising their hands in a public voting hall so that someone like my father can tell them they're wrong. Well, he always huffs, you always vote for the wrong people anyway. Thank God for your mother. My mother's voting ritual is a whole other story. She, like most Americans, doesn't fully comprehend the American political system. I'm convinced that the average American would have an easier time naming Elizabeth Taylor's ex-husbands than, say, his or her congressional leaders. To complicate matters, my mother does not understand English well enough to learn more, which is where my father comes in. As soon as my father receives his voting pamphlet in the mail, he sits on the sofa, pen in hand, and reads it cover to cover. He underlines, he circles, he writes in the margins. If he doesn't know how to vote on an issue, he looks for an endorsement by firemen or police officers. In my father's world, firemen and police officers wear white cowboy hats. If the local firefighters union thinks it's a good idea to raise taxes to build more tap dance studios, then so does my father. Once my father decides how to vote on all the issues, he then practices democracy with a dash of dictatorship thrown in for good measure. He tells my mother how she should vote. My mother rarely questions my father's choices, and when she does, he answers her with one of his typical opinions. Anybody with a brain can tell that's a no vote. Chances are I voted yes. In 1980, however, despite my father's staunch devotion to freedom and fairness, he was still a foreigner with an accent. An accent that after the Iranian Revolution was associated with all things bad. He was treated like someone who should just pack up and go. But go where? After selling our possessions in Iran, Kazem returned to America and started yet again looking for a job. Now, though, he no longer applied to American companies. He eventually applied for a job with a large oil company in Saudi Arabia. This entailed relocating, but we had no choice. By now, my parents had cut up all our credit cards, and our modest savings were disappearing quickly. After weeks of interviews and negotiations, he was offered an executive position, and the contract was ready to sign. My father was hopeful for the first time since being laid off. Before signing the final papers, the lawyer asked for his passport, a requirement for any overseas job. At the sight of the Iranian passport, the lawyer turned pale and said, "I am so sorry, but the government of Saudi Arabia does not accept Iranians at this time. We thought you were an Arab." My father resumed his job search. In the Wall Street Journal, he spotted an ad for an executive position with a Nigerian oil company. He immediately applied and was hired within 2 weeks. With its high salary and unlimited expansion potential, this job almost seemed too good to be true. My father's first assignment was to go to New Jersey and negotiate the purchase of an oil refinery for $400 million. Once that was done, he was sent to Texas to purchase another refinery. He was thrilled to be using his expertise again. After returning from his assignments, my father discovered that his first and only paycheck had bounced. He was told that there had been a small delay with funds being wired from Nigeria and that his second paycheck would cover the first. He had no option but to keep working. A few days later, he came to the office to discover a swarm of journalists looking for information on the hot new breaking story. Apparently, the owner of the company was a con man who had already been deported from the United States once, but had returned under an assumed name. My father packed his office supplies and left. The hostages were finally freed. Besides them and their families, no one was happier than the Iranians living in America. Shortly after their release, my father found a job with an American company working as a senior engineer. His salary was half of what it had been before the revolution, but he was nonetheless extremely grateful to wake up and go to work every day. Throughout his job ordeal, my father never complained. He remained an Iranian who loved his native country, but who also believed in American ideals. He only said how sad it was that people so easily hate an entire population simply because of the actions of a few. And what a waste it is to hate, he always said. What a waste. Girls just want to have fun. With the Iranian Revolution and my family's financial upheaval in the background, I had entered adolescence. At an age when most of my classmates were discovering the Nordstrom shoe department, I had watched my parents cut up their credit cards. Being unfashionable didn't bother me, but I was afraid I couldn't afford to go to college. I needed some funds. Job prospects for 14-year-olds have never been rosy, so I settled on an old standby, babysitting. At $1 per hour, I soon discovered this was not going to get me anywhere. Some of my luckier friends babysat for families who rounded up to the nearest hour or threw in an extra $2 for good measure. I always ended up with people who, after arriving home at midnight on a Saturday night, would spend 15 minutes calculating exactly how much they owed me. 5 hours and 12 minutes, so that's $5.12 divided by 60, that's about 20 cents, or is that 30? Hold on, I need a piece of paper. After having babysat for every frugal family in town, I eventually hit the mother load. My high school French teacher told me of a newly transplanted Parisian family that was looking for a French-speaking babysitter. Even though my French at the time was limited to asking whether Jacques was at the pool with Anne, I volunteered. I was told that the family had only one child, an 8-year-old daughter, and that they lived in Big Canyon, a gated community full of rich people. I arrived with high hopes and a French dictionary. After giving me a tour of their large house, including the 20-foot Buddha in the living room, the father asked me whether $5 an hour would be sufficient. These people had clearly not researched the going rate for babysitters, and if the 20-foot Buddha had not enlightened them, I was not about to start. No diapers, no cooking, just one 8-year-old who would probably go to bed easily, and $5 per hour. This was too good to be true, but I knew it was true, because if anyone deserved a break, it was I. As soon as the parents left, the daughter plunked herself next to me on the posh leather sofa and immediately started hugging me and stroking my hair. I didn't want to get on her bad side early on in this lucrative job, so I smiled as I tried to untangle her arms. The more I tried to extricate myself, the harder she clung. I had no idea the French were so affectionate. I'd been wrestling with the child for half an hour when the lights in the living room went out automatically, and the glass cabinets along the walls lit up from underneath, illuminating an extensive collection of Buddhas. I felt like King Tut, except that I was alive and trapped in a mausoleum with a deranged koala. No matter what I did, I could not get the kid off me. She refused to go to bed. She refused to eat dinner. She refused to budge. With 30 Buddhas watching me, I was suddenly enlightened as to why these people were so generous with the babysitter. When the parents arrived 3 hours later, they found their daughter snoring on the sofa. She had finally fallen asleep, and I had not dared move her, lest she wake up. Normally, parents might be upset by this, but not these people. God knows they were probably relieved to have gotten away from their daughter for a few hours. The father handed me a $20 bill and asked whether I was available the following night. I didn't know how to say in French, "Not for all the tea in China would I return to this freak zone," so I just told him that I had to study for a test. My 3 traumatic hours of babysitting the Klingon convinced me to retire from the field. I decided to switch to house sitting, a far easier yet potentially lucrative line of work. I let all my friends and neighbors know that not only was I available during all vacations, but I was also good with plants. The latter wasn't exactly true, since I didn't own any plants and had never actually taken care of any, but I figured if the soil is dry, I water. My first job consisted of watering the indoor plants belonging to a family a couple of streets away from us, Monday morning, before school, I rode my bike to their house and started watering every plant, just as I had been instructed. All of a sudden, I heard music coming from one of the bedrooms upstairs. I froze. I stood in the kitchen, watering can in hand, unable to scream or move. After a few minutes, I put down the watering can, slowly tiptoed out of the kitchen, and ran out the front door. I could barely ride my bike home with my entire body trembling. My father was in Iran trying to sell our house, and I knew my mother would be of no help. I thought about calling the police, but how would I know whether anything had been stolen? Plus, I didn't know how to reach the family, so I decided to do nothing. After a few days, I imagined all their plants dead. Overcome with guilt, I decided to risk my life and enter the house again. Grabbing our fireplace poker, I rode my bike to their house. As I opened the front door, I yelled, "Dad, keep the dog out! I don't want him to bite anyone! You know how mean he is!" I ran in the house and dumped water on all the plants as fast as I could, even the ones that I had been instructed to gently mist. I continued my conversation with my imaginary dad. "Hold on to his leash!" I screamed. When the family returned a few days later, I told them that they wouldn't have to pay me. I had come to the house only twice because there might have been a robber in the house the previous Monday, listening to music in an upstairs bedroom. "What time were you here?" the wife asked. 7:15 in the morning," I told her. "You heard the clock radio," she informed me. She paid me in full but never asked me to house sit again. Shortly thereafter, another family asked me to take care of their indoor cats for 10 days. Except for the goldfish we bought every year for the Persian New Year, I had never owned a pet, but I accepted the job. These people had 4 cats: Ketchup, Mustard, Relish, and Mayo. I should have known better than to get involved with people who would name their cats after condiments, but common sense is an acquired trait. My first day on the job, I rode my bike to their house and did everything as I'd been told. I emptied the litter box, opened up the stinking cans of cat food, gave the cats 2 scoops of dried food, and filled up their water bowls. I didn't really play with the cats, because like most houses overrun with indoor cats, this one was no treat for the senses. As I was leaving, I noticed that the door to the patio was wide open. I shut and locked it. I returned the next morning to repeat my routine. The cats were meowing considerably more than the day before, but I figured they were hungry. The next day, they were meowing loudly and screeching intermittently. The following day, their intermittent screeches were peppered with leaps across the furniture. I thought that perhaps if I played with them, they might calm down a bit. The problem was that whenever I went near one of them, it would arch its body and snarl. My goldfish had never done that, but I was nonetheless able to understand the international symbol for, "I'm going to scratch out your eyeballs." By the 10th day, these frisky felines spent all their time running around the house in endless circles, screeching and scratching. I chalked up their strange behavior to the absence of their beloved owners. That night, the owners called. "Why did you close the patio door?" the mother screamed at me. "I closed it because it was open," I replied. "How did you expect the cats to get any exercise?" she screamed back. "But I thought they were indoor cats," I told her. "The patio is their play area. Didn't you notice their behavior? You have mentally damaged my cats." "You don't have to pay me," I told her. She paid me, but she never asked me to house sit again. My next job came courtesy of my friend Chris, who informed me that one of her very wealthy neighbors, who happened to be the mother of a very famous clothing designer, was looking for someone to clean her silverware. This job paid $6 per hour. Chris also told me that this woman, whom I will call Mrs. Cheapo to protect her anonymity, had estimated that this was at least a $20 job. I rode my bike to her house, arriving promptly at 8 on a sunny Saturday morning. Mrs. Cheapo led me to her dining room table, where she had a heap of silverware stacked 3 feet high. Judging by the black tarnish, people were still traveling by horse and buggy the last time these pieces were cleaned. She handed me a foul-smelling cream and a couple of washcloths. "Do you have a pair of latex gloves I could borrow?" I asked her. "No, the polish might ruin them." If my life were a movie script written by someone more intelligent than I would have gotten up and gone home, but not before pausing long enough to tell her that her daughter's designs were frumpy. In the real-life version, I got up and told her that I had to go home to get a pair of gloves. I rode my bike home feverishly and returned with my mother's dishwashing gloves. I set to work. Without taking a break, I scrubbed intensely, trying my best not to inhale the noxious fumes. I cleaned every nook and cranny of every fork, spoon, knife, butter knife, cheese server, ice teaspoon, carving knife, and oyster fork, not to mention the pieces whose function completely eluded me. I sorted all the pieces in matching piles and informed her that I was done. "I can't believe you're finished," she squealed, staring at the shiny piles. I was used to hearing that from my teachers at school, but I assumed this declaration of surprise would translate into a fat tip. "Wow," said Mrs. Cheapo, taking out a wad of cash. "Let's see, you were here for 1 hour and 20 minutes, so here's $8. "But I thought this was a $20 job," I reminded her. "Not with you, honey," she said. "It didn't take you that long." I should have hurled a few oyster forks at her, but instead I thanked her and rode my bike home. She was right about one thing. The polish did ruin the gloves. Through my friend Marilyn, I found out that the local movie theater was looking for summer help. I was hired to work at the concession stand, where I was responsible for selling the type of food that should come with a free angiogram. The popcorn came in 4 sizes, small, medium, large, and jumbo. During the entire summer, only 3 people ordered the small popcorn. They were European and had apparently come to watch the movie. Most patrons ordered the jumbo popcorn, a snack whose container could double as an infant bathtub. The instructions were always the same. Please put butter in the bottom, middle, and top. No dry spots. Not even when my relatives ended their fasts, during the holy month of Ramadan, had I seen people consume this much food. The lobby of the movie theater was plastered with signs declaring, "Our popcorn is made with real butter." Judging by our brisk popcorn sales, I suggested to my manager that perhaps a similar advertising campaign might improve hot dog sales. "Our hot dogs are made with real innards." Just like Galileo's, my ideas were rejected. The most popular drink that summer was Tab, a diet soda that tasted like liquid tin. Unfortunately, our Tab machine was always broken, and we offered no other diet drinks. After placing an order for the jumbo popcorn with extra butter, most people asked for a large Tab. This is when things got ugly. "What?" they would always scream at me. "It's broken!" Then they'd ask to see the manager, as if through sheer assertiveness they could get the machine fixed. I always had the urge to enlighten them. "Look, you're about to consume 10,000 calories of fat, so a diet drink isn't going to make a difference. In fact, may I suggest some innards?" My summer at the movie theater taught me one thing. I had to look for a better paying job, preferably one that did not involve selling jujubes. A string of jobs followed, but none ever paid well. My efforts at amassing funds were not hugely successful. Watching me trying to save money, my father repeatedly told me how bad he felt at being unable to help with my college tuition. He spent his days lamenting his inability to foresee the revolution and the ensuing economic collapse. I should have sold everything and brought the money to America a long time ago, became his mantra. As college approached, I stumbled upon a talent better than selling popcorn or polishing silver. I started writing scholarship essays. I wrote essay after essay about my life and my dreams and my goals. I wrote about volunteering as a clown in a children's hospital. I wrote about being my mother's interpreter. I wrote that ever since I was a little girl, I had wanted to go to college. And I wrote that my Aunt Cédire should have been able to go to college, but instead had to get married when she was 14. And the funds just flowed in. Joyeuse Noël. One Saturday morning during my junior year of high school, I showed up at the University of California at Irvine to compete in an impromptu speech contest sponsored by the Alliance Française, a French language school. I, along with a few dozen college and high school students, was given 1 hour to prepare a speech in French entitled Responsibility Toward Technology. The first prize was 2 months at the Alliance Française in Paris. I had been taking French since seventh grade, and under the tutelage of my high school teacher, Mr. Pokinghorn, affectionately known as Le Poc, I had become quite fluent. My fellow high school students often asked me how I had managed to learn the language so quickly. I always told them that it had something to do with my inability to do a cartwheel, shoot a basket, or roller skate. God had to compensate somehow. To qualify for the contest, all participants had to sign a statement saying that they had never spent more than 2 weeks in a French-speaking country and that neither parent was a native speaker. My parents' French was limited to a handful of words that had crept into Persian, including mini-jupe, mini-skirt, bigoudi, hair roller, abat-jour, lampshade, and coup d'état. The French word most commonly used in Iran was chic, a word that accurately described what we were not. The only language heard in our house besides Persian was shushtari, a version of old Persian spoken by my father and his family, whose ancestors came from the historic city of Shushtar in southern Iran. About 1,750 years ago, King Shapur I led the Persians in a fight against the Roman Emperor Valerian. After winning the battle, the Persians brought the captured Roman engineers to Shushtar to design dams, water mills, artificial canals, and an irrigation system, many of which still work today. If Walt Disney had ever seen Shushtar, he would have created ancient land to be nestled alongside frontier land and fantasy land. The language of Shushtari, with its abundance of animal and plant imagery, reflects the simple agricultural life of its residents. Many words exist in Shushtari that do not exist in Persian. For instance, the word peshkel means animal droppings that are round like a goat's or sheep's. When two people look alike, my Aunt Sedira describes them as being like two halves of a peshkel. And to reveal what is truly valuable in life, my Aunt Fatime always uses the Shushtari proverb, any gift from a true friend is valuable, even if it's a hollow walnut shell. It's fair to say that the Shushtari floating in my house did not give me any edge in the French language. It did, however, teach me that people sometimes talk louder and laugh harder in their native tongue, as evidenced by my father and his siblings. It also trained my ear for accents and thus eventually got me into trouble. Even though I was the youngest contestant in the impromptu speech contest, I placed first. Unbeknownst to me, this was met with suspicion. Apparently, some people thought that my Parisian accent was too authentic for a foreigner. Perhaps taking their cue from Detective Clouseau, a couple of the judges decided to do a little investigative work. After the contest, my parents started receiving phone calls in French. They became a somewhat regular, although inexplicable, part of our lives. The phone would ring, and then my father or mother would say, "Wait, wait, please, Firouze!" I would pick up the receiver to find somebody from the Alliance Française with a piddling question or comment. I would like to verify the spelling of your last name. I would like to congratulate you personally. Have you read anything by Camus? He's quite good. These French phone calls made my already nervous parents even more anxious. Why do they keep speaking French with us if they know we don't speak the language? They always ask me. I had no clue. I just assumed they were forgetful. My mother finally reached her own conclusion. Nobody understands their English, concluded my mother, and they know that. 2 weeks after my 17th birthday, I was on an airplane bound for Paris. I was scheduled to arrive 2 days before the national celebration of the French Revolution, Bastille Day. I had never been so excited in my entire life. I couldn't wait to meet my host family. I couldn't wait to eat an authentic baguette. I couldn't wait to make French friends. This was going to be the best summer of my entire life, the kind of summer that somebody would want to make a movie out of. And as soon as I set foot in the Paris airport, I was whisked away by two gendarmes. I had no idea that traveling with an Iranian passport would qualify me for special treatment. These men found it odd that 3 years after the revolution, a 17-year-old Iranian should be traveling by herself and staying in Paris for 2 months. In a small, windowless room, I explained to them in French, but with a perky Southern California demeanor, all about the contest and how I had won and how much I was looking forward to seeing the Louvre and going to cafes and eating a crepe on a street corner. You don't know anybody in Paris? They asked me. Did anyone give you any materials to distribute? How is it that you speak French so well if you are only a student of French? Do you plan on returning to America afterward? These people clearly thought my life was a lot more exciting than it was. After answering all their questions, I had to endure the luggage search. My suitcase, roughly the size of a coffin, was on loan from Aunt Sedire. It had previously been used to transport two large Persian rugs and an entire samovar set from Iran. The gendarmes started sifting through the clothes and the myriad of gifts I had brought for my host family. When they reached the stuffed Minnie Mouse, they decided they had had enough. They zipped up my suitcase and politely wished me a nice stay. After my rendezvous with the welcoming committee, I searched the airport for someone carrying a sign with my name on it. Once I found her, I was greeted with, "Where have you been?" I explained to her that I was a VIP, a very Iranian person, and things just take longer for us. Before coming to Paris, I had corresponded once with my host family, mainly to find out what kinds of gifts to bring. Michel and Christiane were journalists working for Libération, a left-leaning newspaper. They also had a six-month-old daughter. I had envisioned myself spending evenings having enlightening discussions over home-cooked French meals. Pass the béarnaise sauce, please, and tell me again, Michel, what do you really think of the ramifications of industrialism in 19th-century France? Upon arriving, I gave them the gifts, the coffee table book on California, the signed limited edition print of the Ferris wheel on Balboa Island, the t-shirts from Newport Beach, the homemade chocolate chip cookies, the homemade baklava, and the large Minnie Mouse. Once my hosts had opened all the presents, Christiane blithely informed me that the next morning they would be leaving for the countryside, where they would be staying for the entire summer. But here were the keys to the apartment. She also told me the location of the nearest 24-hour market. I then did what any self-respecting person would do. I asked to go with them. "Non," replied Christiane. It became painfully obvious to me that there was to be no cultural exchange with these people. The only exchange they were interested in was the exchange of currency between them and the rental office. Michel and Christiane's small apartment on the Rue de Tourbigo was filled with books and magazines. Bookshelves lined every room. From Japanese art to Russian literature to the works of Dante and Joyce, every topic was covered, except, of course, hospitality. Had I not met Michel and Christiane, but simply stayed in their apartment, I probably would have liked them. The tiny bathroom came with a 3-year stack of Zoom, a photography magazine that prominently featured breasts in every pictorial, but in an intellectual way. For a spread on the disappearing tribes of Africa, the locals were featured alongside a lineup of topless Caucasian models wearing African masks. What better way to showcase the wildflowers of Provence than by painting a few topless models purple and placing them among the flowers? Even the ads followed the same theme. In a coffee ad, a dark-skinned model was featured sitting on a hill of beans. Both the beans and the model were naked. During my years as a French student, every textbook I had ever read had elaborated upon the unforgettable jubilance known as Bastille Day, the parade down the Champs-Élysées, the fireworks, the general merriment, and the cherished memories born only of this event. Sitting alone in the apartment the day after my arrival, I realized that I was going to be spending this momentous holiday by myself in a tiny apartment far away from the festivities. Since I knew nobody in Paris, I decided to go talk to the concierge to see if she had any ideas. According to my books on French culture, concierges were usually old ladies living alone on the ground floor of apartment buildings. They were usually pictured peeking from behind their lace curtains to see the comings and goings of the apartment dwellers. One is supposed to consult the concierge about the mail or a lost key, never for social advice. But I was desperate. I knocked on the door and was pleasantly surprised to be greeted by Noelle, a plump, jovial woman in her early 40s. I explained to her that I had just arrived in Paris from California and was looking for something to do on Bastille Day. The minute she heard the word California, she perked up even more. "Une Californienne!" she exclaimed. I didn't really want to disappoint her by pointing out that I was actually an Iranian, so I just smiled. She wanted to know whether I lived near Hollywood and whether I knew any famous people. I explained to her that I lived an hour away from Hollywood. As for famous people, I thought of telling her that my father is directly descended from the Prophet Muhammad, but I knew that wasn't the kind of famous person she was inquiring about. Noelle told me to meet her the following night so we could go to the Champs-Élysées together. She said she couldn't wait. Neither could I. The next evening, I put on a Hawaiian shirt, jeans, and the spanking new Adidas sneakers I had bought for my trip. I knocked on Noelle's door, but the woman who answered bore no resemblance to the concierge I had met the night before. Noelle was clad in a body-hugging red knit dress that accentuated her ample curves. The plunging neckline barely covered her enormous chest. With each breath she took, I expected her bosom to just break free and come out to watch the parade with us. We started walking the 3 blocks to the metro station, catching the attention of every creepy male in the city of lights. As Noelle jiggled and wiggled down the street, I thought of just skipping the parade since we had managed to start our own. During the long metro ride, we sat surrounded by the kind of men I always associate with windowless vans bearing bumper stickers that say, "If this van's a-rockin', don't come a-knockin'." Unlike me, Noelle was completely enamored of the attention, although to her credit, she never talked to any of the men. She was too busy inquiring about California, and specifically, California men. In search of a husband, she told me, she had recently moved to Paris from the countryside, but she was hugely disappointed with the men. According to her, they were all married. I was surprised that she had any minimum standards, since her dress and high heels gave the impression that anyone in possession of a simple set of one X and one Y chromosome would suffice. We reached the Champs-Élysées approximately 10 minutes after the rest of the population of Western Europe. Noelle and I moved around trying to find a good spot, but no matter where we went, all we could see was the backs of people's heads. I didn't think anything could be worse than the after-Christmas sale at Nordstrom, but I was clearly wrong. The parade started and ended. I saw nothing. Once the festivities were over, Noelle and I made our way to the metro station, only to find that the same 14 rows of people who had been ahead of us at the parade were now ahead of us in line for the train. Pas de problème, chirped Noelle. Nous chercherons un taxi. The idea of looking for a taxi was a fine one, except that apparently all the drivers had taken the night off. They'd probably been standing in front of us at the parade. After walking half a dozen blocks, Noelle suggested that we just walk the rest of the way home. It was 1 a.m. Normally, I cannot stay awake past 10 o'clock. My goal throughout high school was to stay up long enough to watch Saturday Night Live. I never made it. In college, my parents had no need to worry about my getting involved with drugs and alcohol, since by the time most parties started, I was in my third cycle of REM sleep. I am also legendary among my friends for my complete lack of a sense of direction, making me the perfect kidnap victim, no blindfold necessary. Drive me anywhere and I will be unable to find my way back. It was therefore a great irony that I found myself in a foreign city trying to make my way home way past my bedtime. I spent the entire walk home making deals with God. If you just get me home, I will never ask for anything again. Between conversations with the Almighty, I listened for the click-click of Noelle's heels, a Morse code of sorts, to guide me back to the Rue de Tourbigot. By then, we had run out of conversation, or rather, Noelle had nothing more to say about men. Much to her disappointment, I didn't have much to contribute on the topic, since I was, to put it kindly, a late bloomer. School started a few days later. The classes, like the Bastille Day parade, were a huge disappointment. All my teachers were in their early 20s, and none seemed very interested in teaching. Perhaps they resented being stuck in Paris during the summer, a season when the French normally evacuate the capital. One teacher spent the whole time flirting with the men in class while completely ignoring the women. Another made us translate the lyrics of the works of Jacques Brel, a famous performer whose songs would have been appropriate for Suicide, the musical. We spent hours plodding through the songs while our teacher sat with a far-off look in her eyes. My English versions did not do them justice, but then again, the teacher had a certain hands-off style of teaching, a style that translated into her sitting in the corner recalling perhaps a summer spent elsewhere. She helped us only reluctantly, as when none of our dictionaries had the word putain, slang for prostitute. With apologies to Monsieur Brel, the song, Jeff. No, Jeff, you're not alone. Stop crying like that in front of everyone, because a fake blonde dumped you yet again. No, Jeff, you're not alone, but I'm ashamed to see you cry shamelessly in front of everybody, because a three-quarter whore popped out of your life. Then we moved on to Fernand, a funerary march. To think that Fernand is dead, to think that Fernand has died, to think that I'm the only one behind, to think that he's the only one in front. Him in his last beer, me in my fog, him in his hearse, me in my desert. By the end of that song, we were able to conjugate the verb to die in every tense. Had I made some friends during my melancholic French lessons, I would have at least been a few degrees happier than Jeff or Fernand. Unfortunately, the students in my classes were quite a bit older than I was, and most were newly arrived immigrants struggling to learn French. These were not people hoping to find Gertrude Stein's favorite haunt. They were hoping to find a job. The few interesting people I did meet were leaving in 3 days to go somewhere else. No one, except for the people selling keychains under the Eiffel Tower, actually stayed in Paris during the summer. The upside of my lonely 2 months was that I became completely fluent in French. Having loads of free time, I also managed to see just about every museum in the city. Whatever culture I lacked after having spent 6 years in Southern California, I more than made up for. The downside of my summer was realizing that maybe the joys of being 17, even in Paris, were highly exaggerated. I wondered if the summer somehow foreshadowed the rest of my life. Maybe I was doomed to a really lonely existence, where the only pleasure came not from human company, but from croissants. Maybe someday I would end up thinking Jacques Brel's lyrics were uplifting. A few months after my return to California, I received a letter from Noelle letting me know that she had moved to New Caledonia, where, according to her, the ratio of men to women was 5-1. I remembered her kindness in taking me to the Champs-Élysées on Bastille Day to fulfill one of my dreams. Granted, she had mistaken me for a real Californian, someone who perhaps knew Paul Newman or Cher. But in exchange for making one of my dreams come true, I sincerely hoped that she would find Monsieur Merveilleux waiting for her on that little island in the Pacific. If someone were to make a movie of my summer in Paris, it would not be the touching coming-of-age film I had hoped for, but rather a black and white filled with close-ups of furrowed brows and croissant crumbs. There would be no theme song, just the sound of the metro doors opening and closing and opening and closing. Against this backdrop of teenage angst, there would have to be a symbol, a representation of the confidence that comes with eventual intellectual and spiritual growth. This would, bien sûr, be most effectively depicted by the judicious scattering of topless models in the background. The wedding. My marriage started out with a big, fat lie. I told my parents that François's family was happy about our engagement. I had to. In the Iranian culture, fathers will consent to a marriage only if the future groom and his family worship the bride. There is no getting around this detail. If there's any problem with the groom's family, forget it. Engagement off, moving on to the next suitor. When I first started dating François, his mother declared that I would never be allowed to set foot in her house. This was before she met me. Before meeting me, François had a longtime French girlfriend. From all accounts, she was an intelligent and capable person, but she was Jewish. Her religion was a problem until François started dating me. Compared to a Muslim, the Jewish girlfriend didn't seem so bad after all. I once asked François if there was anybody he could have dated that would have bothered his mother more. Well, he said, a black communist bisexual would have really irked her. My parents had a completely different reaction to François. They first heard of him during the summer after my junior year in college, 6 months after we had met. For 5.5 of those months, François and I had known we were going to get married, but had not said anything to our parents. I had simply informed my parents that I was dating somebody, and I wanted them to meet him. Dating, like the rodeo circuit or trout farming, is a completely foreign concept to my parents. They, like all their sisters and brothers, never dated, their marriages having been arranged by family members. My mother learned what she knows about dating from Days of Our Lives, especially Hope and Beau's tumultuous relationship. The only dates my father knew about contained pits. The first time they met François, my parents insisted on taking him to the nicest Persian restaurant in Los Angeles. My father ordered the appetizer sampler, which François ate with gusto while questioning my mother about the ingredients. Is this spiced sumac? Are these the thin-skinned Persian cucumbers? Is the feta made with sheep's milk? Once the appetizers were finished, François selected the most copious dish on the menu, the sultani, a combination of lamb, beef, and chicken kebab on an enormous mound of rice. His order arrived, looking as though someone had just grilled an entire petting zoo. François ate and ate and ate. My father asked me, in Persian, whether he always ate like this. My mother said, in Persian, that she hoped he wasn't going to get sick. Meanwhile, François kept eating. By the time he was done, there was not a grain of rice left on his large oval plate. My mother told him how lucky he was that he could eat enough food for 3 people and not be fat. François was of normal weight, although he did outweigh me, which fulfilled one of 2 requirements for dating a guy. The other requirement was a total lack of interest in watching sports on television. François fulfilled that one too. Unbelievably, he ordered dessert, exclaiming that he couldn't possibly imagine skipping the rose water and pistachio ice cream. By then, I was just hoping that if he did throw up, it wouldn't happen in my father's car. Once we arrived at my house, I asked François why he had eaten so much. I know that Middle Easterners love to feed people, and I wanted to make a good impression on your parents, he said, but I need to go lie down now. My parents did like François, not because of his appetite for Persian food, but because he was kind and because I was in love with him. My mother had always hoped that I would marry an Iranian doctor, someone whom she could speak to without an interpreter, a man whose parents would consider me the best thing that had ever happened to their son.